Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 20th, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Supreme Court's ruling in Alice Corp. versus CLS Bank. My name is David Ray, and I'm the Associate Director of the Practice Group at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Professor Adam Mossoff of the George Mason University School of Law. A more complete bio of Professor Mossoff was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. With that, Professor Mossoff, the floor is yours.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here today to speak about the Supreme Court's decision handed down yesterday in Alice Corp. versus CLS Bank, a unanimous decision with Justice Thomas writing the opinion. In my remarks today, I'm just going to give a quick introduction about the case and provide a little bit of a background, and talk a little bit about the oral argument, which I also did a Courthouse Steps teleforum on back in late March, and then I will talk about the opinion that was handed down yesterday. And there's a lot one could say about the opinion, so I'm just going to be touching on three issues, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers from the audience. So let's begin. So this case is a very important case. It was a very significant decision. Or at least much awaited decision. It represents the fourth in a line of cases in recent years in which the Supreme Court has been engaging with this issue of what types of discoveries or inventions can be secured in the patent system as discoveries or inventions. So before you even get to the question of whether a discovery or invention is new, whether it's useful, whether it is what's referred to as non-obvious, it's not just an obvious step in the next direction in the evolution of some technology, and also whether it's fully disclosed. Those are the basic requirements for how you can secure a legitimate patent under the law. There's this kind of predicate question, this step zero, sometimes I refer to it as, is this even count as an invention? Over the years, the Supreme Court has developed various categories which they have referred to as unpatentable. It includes abstract ideas, laws of nature, and physical phenomena. And this case represent the case of Alice Corp. versus CLS Bank really represented, as I said, a development in the past several years of the Supreme Court being very interested in this first step analysis and whether an invention actually can be secure or discovery can be secured in the patent system, as well as a culmination of a very long-running legal and policy dispute that has been occurring in the patent system and in the culture more broadly about whether innovations in the high-tech industry with respect to software, what is referred to as a technical term as computer-implemented technologies, whether these actually are protectable under the patent system or not, whether these fit a type of machine or process that can be secured under the patent system, or do these really count as an abstract idea? Now, in this case, the Alice Corporation was the patent owner, and they owned a patent that covered both a method and a computer system for managing risk in complex financial transactions. So essentially, it was a method as well as a computer system that implemented that method for ensuring basically that people did not, for lack of a better word, kind of fudge on their commitments. So in some type of complex transaction, for instance, in an international currency transaction, someone actually follows through on their commitment to buy a certain amount of for instance, dollars, or sell a certain amount of yen, was one of the examples used in the brief. Alice Corp, who owned this patent, was making indications to CLS Bank, which engages in a substantial amount of these transactions, amounting into the hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars, that it was that CLS Bank's computer system and its methods were infringing. So CLS Bank immediately went to court and sought to invalidate Alice Corp's patent through a special type of action called a declaratory judgment action, where they're asking a court to declare that the patent is invalid. Alice Corp responded to this lawsuit being filed by CLS Bank by filing a patent infringement action against CLS Bank, and thus the parties were engaged. At the district court level, the district court held actually that Alice Corp's patents were invalid. Alice Corp appealed to the Federal Circuit, and things got kind of complicated at the Federal Circuit. There was a panel decision, and then eventually the Federal Circuit granted a review en banc. And in May of 2013, a little over a year ago, they handed down a decision that if ever there was an exemplar of a fractured court decision, this is it. So there were seven opinions amounting to a total of 68 total pages. Not one of the opinions actually garnered a majority of the judges in the Federal Circuit. The only opinion that was ultimately issued was a one-paragraph opinion, per curiam, unsigned, that said the patents are invalid. So the parties filed for cert. The Supreme Court granted cert. And the question that they granted cert on is whether computer-implemented inventions, including claims to systems and machines, processes, and items of manufacture, are directed to patent-eligible subject matter within the meaning of the patent statutes as interpreted by the court. So the question that they granted cert on was very, very broad. And effectively, this became the case in which everyone expected the U.S. Supreme Court to essentially say, is innovation in high-tech software, is that something that can be secured under the patent system as type of innovation that one can legitimately have property rights in and go into the marketplace and sell? Now, this is a very, very important question because people often don't realize to the extent to which software is pervasive in our lives today, because it's not just software on computers that people usually think of as the classic example of software. They think of their word processing program like Word, or their email client like Thunderbird, or they think of the software being run on their smartphone, whether it's an Apple iOS system or whether it's an Android system. They think of their apps like Angry Bird. They think of those as software, but people don't realize that there's actually software in everything now. There's software in your Keurig coffee machines. There's software in automobiles. There's software in refrigerators. There's software in dishwashers. It's pervasive in our economy, and it's pervasive in the products and services that have that have brought amazing technological innovation and high qualities of life for everyone in our country. So this case, because of the very broad question that the court granted cert on, the case garnered a lot of attention and a lot of concern, especially from companies in the innovation industries who have developed business models and are selling products and services based upon software technology. Ranging across the board from classic software companies like IBM and Microsoft all the way through to the manufacturers. In fact, there were 41 amicus briefs that were filed in this case, in addition to a brief submitted by the Solicitor General. And it was expected that this is going to be a very significant decision and a very prominent decision. And in fact, the decision that came down yesterday, while certainly significant, was very surprising in many respects. And before I get to the issues about the opinion that I'd like to highlight before we get into our question and answer period, I'll just note that the opinion that was issued yesterday was very short. The majority opinion by Justice Thomas is 17 pages in the slip opinion, and then there's an additional one-paragraph concurring opinion by Justice Sotomayor, who's joined by Justice Ginsburg and Breyer. It's a unanimous decision. A lot of people were expecting this to be a split decision of sort. And it was very surprising because, in part because of the first issue that I like to talk about, which is that the opinion ended up being very narrow. Very, very narrow indeed. As I mentioned, the question that the Supreme Court granted cert on is whether computer implemented inventions are patentable under the patent system, or are these abstract ideas that you exclude? The classic example of an abstract idea that is excluded from the patent system, for instance, is E equals MC squared. Right? That is just, that's an abstract idea about the nature of the world. It also is a law of nature, also excluded from the patent system. That is not a true technological innovation. And as many people on this call probably have heard, it's often claimed that, well, computer software is just an algorithm, it's binary code, it's mathematics, and so it's similar to E equals MC squared, or to be more precise, it's similar to 2 plus 2 equals 4, and therefore this really shouldn't be patented or not. And this is what people thought the Supreme Court was going to be weighing in on and going to be issuing its decision on. And in fact, in contrast to the very broad cert question, the holding, as stated by Justice Thomas in the opening paragraph of the opinion, is, we hold that the claims at issue are drawn to the abstract idea of intermediated settlement, and that merely requiring generic computer implementation fails to transform that abstract idea into a patentable eligible invention. We therefore affirm the judgment of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. So what we got, and this is notable, is a very narrow decision. This particular patent is invalid because it covers an abstract idea, which is the idea of managing risk in complex financial transactions between parties in the marketplace. And in fact, the court was able to cite to books from the 19th century that describe the type of business method that was used to manage this risk and to mediate this risk as an example of how this is a very old abstract idea in the business world. And so instead of handing down an opinion that spoke writ large to whether the types of innovation that one sees in the high-tech industry with respect to word processing programs, email, the programs that make possible the internet, a lot of people don't realize actually that the internet rests on a technology called packet switching technology, that was actually patented by its inventors. Whether those actually are technological inventions capable of being secured in the patent system as new types of digital machines or processes, the Supreme Court did not directly answer that question. Instead, it decided to keep itself focused on the narrow question presented to it about the patent in this particular case. Now, the reason for that was made very clear, I believe, in oral argument. In oral argument, the justices repeatedly expressed concern that while they all recognized, in fact, the justices were fairly uniform across the board that they believed that this particular patent was invalid. That was repeatedly signaled by the justices during the oral argument. They also recognized that there was a significant amount of innovation, legitimate technological innovation in the high-tech industry that is deserving of patent protection. And so they were constantly wrestling with this issue of how do we formulate a test, or how do we draw the line where we can exclude this type of invalid patent, the patent held by Alice Corp, which the justices made clear they believed it was invalid, from the valid types of technological innovation that occur in the high-tech software context with respect to encryption programs and other types of enterprise software systems. There were some impressive amicus briefs filed by IBM and other representatives from the innovation industries that detailed at length the billions of dollars that have gone into investments and production of these types of technologies as reflective of the fact that they are true technological innovations, and they identified the impact that these have had on our economy. And in fact, in an op-ed just published last week or a week or so ago by David Kapos, the former director of the Patent Office, he detailed the fact that that the innovation industries and IP-intensive industries generally are responsible for trillions of dollars of added value to the U.S. economy every year. That surveys have repeatedly shown that this number ranges anywhere from $5 to $8 trillion. And high-tech innovation is certainly a component of that, and patents have certainly played a very important role in securing to companies the types of massive R&D expenditures that they've had to make to develop the types of operating systems and other types of programs that have revolutionized our lives. And so justices did not want it was clear in the oral argument, the justices felt like that, well, we don't want to create a rule that says that this is an abstract idea that ends up actually eliminating the ability of all of these legitimate technological innovations to be secured in the patent system. And so given that repeated concern that was expressed in oral argument, while the brevity of the opinion is somewhat surprising, it's not entirely surprising that they ended up actually avoiding the larger question and sticking to the narrow question that was presented to them in the opinion. Does this particular patent cover a true invention that can be secured under the patent system, or is it an abstract idea? And the justices concluded that, as expressed to Justice Thomas, that it is not. Now, the second issue about the opinion it follows directly upon that that conclusion, which is that this case follows, as I mentioned earlier, a series of cases in which the Supreme Court has been reengaging with patent jurisprudence generally, and specifically with this question of what counts as a patentable invention. In the patent law context, this is known as patentable subject matter. You can't patent an abstract idea or a law of nature or a physical phenomenon. Those are not patentable subject matter. What's only patentable are technological innovations. So starting in 2010 with its decision in Bilski versus Kappos with respect to business methods, and then running up through its decision in Mayo v. Prometheus in 2012, which involved a diagnostic method, and then last year in its decision AMP versus Myriad in 2013, which involved the isolated DNA in a laboratory, and then this year, Alice Court versus CLS Bank, the Supreme Court has now decided four cases on this issue of what counts as patentable subject matter. In this case, directly follows upon these earlier cases. And in fact, one aspect of this case is that it solidifies and made clear from these earlier cases, in particular its decision in 2012 in the Mayo versus Prometheus case, that the test that it had set forth there was the test that the court took very seriously and expected the courts to follow. Now, what is that test? In the abstract, it's a two-step test. The first step does the patent claim cover an abstract idea? And if the answer to that is yes, then you move to the second step, which is there something that has been added to that abstract idea sufficient enough to make it therefore fall within the broader category of a technological innovation that we can then secure in the patent system as long as it also meets the other requirements of the patent statutes, that it's new, it's useful, it's non-obvious, and it's ultimately fully and properly disclosed in the patent. The Justice Thomas recognizes in the Alice Corp decision that this is not an easy test as such to apply, and part of the reason why it's not been easy is because they've provided very little guidance on what it means to apply this test. So, for instance, on the first step, does the claim cover an abstract idea? Well, that seems to be the core question here, and they've really provided zero legal guidance on this question. Beyond this kind of "we know it when we see it" type of attitude. This looks to us to be abstract because, well, people have always known of this idea or something else like that. They sometimes invoke what is sometimes in patent law referred to as a preemption concern. Well, does this preempt follow-on development of research and technology? Well, that can't be your basis for determining whether something's abstract or not, because by definition, all patents preempt what follows on because a patent secures an exclusive rights. And therefore, just for instance, the same reason that your ownership of a plot of land preempts someone from being able to walk across that land at will, a patent preempts someone from using that technology for the term of the patent, which is 20 years from date of application. Moreover, on the second step, if it's abstract, is there something that has been added to it? This has been referred to as the inventive step inquiry. Is there an inventive step above and beyond the abstract idea? Again, the concern or problem here is that, well, when you start asking questions of, well, is there an inventive step here, then you're no longer in the area of asking whether this is actually a technological innovation that should be secure in the patent system as such. What you're asking is the questions that fall in the other patent doctrines. Is this actually new? Or even more importantly, is it non-obvious? Is this a true inventive advance over the over prior inventions and prior technological development that had occurred before this particular invention or discovery was made. And so one of the concerns here that you hear often expressed is that this test provides zero guidance, because at a certain level, which the court certainly reflected in Bilski, the accusation that the patent claim covers something that's abstract tends to be a conclusory assertion. It consists of typically a one paragraph or two paragraphs of quote analysis unquote, where they basically say, this looks abstract to me, this sounds like an abstract idea, and that's the end of it. To the extent to which they then try to justify, well, what they mean by abstract idea, well, then they end up getting into the other legal doctrines and tests for coming up with a patentable invention. They start asking questions like, well, is this actually new? Or is this actually something that was obvious to people who were working in the field? For instance, you saw this in the decision in this case in particular, where the Supreme Court cites to a treatise or to a work from the 19th century that described the financial transaction process that was covered by the patent in this case. Well, that's a question as to whether this is new, not whether it's abstract or not. And so in effect, what you get is a statement of a clear statement in the abstract of a quote test unquote. But that test actually, in substance, provides almost no guidance whatsoever to courts as to how to apply it, particularly how they apply it relative to the other requirements in the patent system for whether one has an invention that can be secured legitimately under the as a patent, so whether it's new or novel or non-obvious. So that's a real concern, because what you're seeing is this ongoing development of through the Bilski decision in 2010, Mayo in 2012, Myriad in 2013, and now Alice Corporation in 2014, where the court is continually striking down patents as being either abstract ideas, laws of nature, or physical phenomenon, and providing almost no guidance whatsoever to either the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit or to district courts as to actually how to apply these decisions in any definitive manner with certainty, such that the inventors and commercial firms working in the innovation industries will know with certainty, if we come up with another invention, we can actually get protection for it. Now, this is a real concern, and not just something in the abstract, because Justice Thomas even acknowledges, and this is a well-worn cliche in patent law, that underlying every invention is an abstract idea. You can reduce any invention down to a basic law of nature, such as E equals MC square, or you know, you can reduce the processes used in industrial patents down to the laws of thermodynamics and other types of abstract ideas or laws of nature. And so, you know, what ends up happening is just the level of abstraction at which how a judge chooses to cast the nature of the invention, and that can't be what we ultimately want trillions of dollars of our innovation economy to be resting upon, as a judge's basically arbitrary choice as to how they choose to abstractly define the nature of the invention that's covered by the patent. So that's of a significant concern from this decision. It's a concern that is expressed repeatedly by many representatives and stakeholders in the innovation industries, and I don't think it's a concern that should be taken lightly. Now, with that stated, I do think that there is actually a good aspect to this decision, and that's what I wanted to end on. This is the third kind of issue that I wanted to identify from the opinion before we open it up to question and answer period, and I wanted to go out on a high note. And the high note is that one often hears in the policy debates today from critics of what are referred to as software patents that the Supreme Court has ruled that you cannot get a patent on software. And first of all, that is actually untrue. The Supreme Court has never actually expressly said software is unpatentable. Now, what the Supreme Court has said is an algorithm, like a mathematical algorithm, is unpatentable. And what these critics are engaging in is a conflation between software as a useful product in the marketplace that consumers use to produce things or use in their lives as a service with pure mathematics. Now, that can't be true. And as a, just as a kind of basic observation, a word processing program is not the same thing as 2 plus 2 equals 4. You use a word processing program or the word processing program elements built into, for instance, your email client to actually produce written materials. In effect, a word processing program is a digital machine. It's a digital typewriter. And in fact, the aspects of the digital machine make it possible to do even more with that program, that word processing program, than you could with a mechanical analog typewriter. That's why we have cut and paste and italics and all of these other types of formatting options. And more importantly, no one would deny that hardware, like computer hardware, like the silicon chips that computers use to run, are patentable inventions. In fact, people who are critics of software freely admit that hardware is a patentable machine or manufacturer. It's a product that is made in the real world. And you can build actually into the binary logic circuits of a chip the exact programming functions that you have in a word processing program like Word. And so in effect, there is no difference in principle between a word processing program that you download off of on your broadband connection off of the internet onto your computer as a software program and the type of binary logic programming that's built into the very hardware circuits that software program resides on at times in your computer. And in fact, this was one of the important recognitions by the courts in the 1980s and 1990s, which led to them to recognize that software, in fact, is in the metaphor that was used at the time, is that this is a digital machine, just like the digital machines and hardware, and just like prior analog machines like typewriters, and therefore these are patentable inventions. The Supreme Court has never said that software is not patentable. And in this particular case, the Supreme Court indicates very clearly that it does believe that computer implemented inventions, which is the technical term that are used in the patent policy or in the patent policy in legal circles, the computer implemented inventions actually are valid patents. And the court indicates this towards the end of its decision, where it's talking about where Justice Thomas is talking about how this is not that they don't want to also craft a rule that can simply be drafted around. That this is a substantive requirement of patent law that you can't patent an abstract idea. And the court notes, and in this context, they say that computer implemented claims can be formally addressed to patentable eligible subject matter. End quote. And that's a very significant statement, because that whole discussion about the fact that, well, you can direct these things to patentable eligible subject matter, but they may not substantively cover patentable eligible subject matter, necessarily means that there can be computer claims that cover legitimate computer implemented technologies, and that these are differentiated from those that are deemed to be invalid, like the one in this case. So you actually have a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court where they are saying this particular computer implemented technology is we deem to be an abstract idea and therefore not patentable. And that is differentiated against what would be computer implemented technologies that would be in fact legitimately secured under the patent system. And in the oral argument, there was some discussion about what would be those types of programs, encryption programs, and others would be examples of those. But there are many, many others. In conclusion, I think I've been talking long enough. I'd like to say those are kind of the three big, I think, interesting issues from the opinion. It ended up not fulfilling the promise that the Supreme Court had actually made in granting cert, but nonetheless, there are some significant aspects to it. So, as I said, as a preliminary matter, it was a very narrow opinion. Second, it continued to sow the substantial amount of uncertainty about how to apply the test with respect to what counts as an abstract idea or law of nature versus a patentable invention. In fact, Justice Thomas fairly explicitly punts on this issue in the opinion, where he says, we don't need to draw the line in this opinion between where what is an abstract idea and what is a patentable invention as a general matter, because it's unnecessary because we've decided in this case as a particular matter that this patent covers an abstract idea. And so they disclaim actually formulating any test to do so, and that may be an admission that they actually may not be possible to do so in any meaningful way that actually would appropriately bring the patent system within the domain of covering legitimate technological inventions. And then the last point, as I said, which is a very significant point, is that the court concedes that there are computer-implemented technologies such as software programs that are legitimate technological innovations and should be secured under the patent system. So with that, David, I'll turn it back over to you to see if there are any questions from the audience that they might have.
Well, thank you, Professor Mossoff, for your presentation. And I will now open the floor to your questions. And in a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, you enter the star button on your keypad and then the pound button. And when we get to your request, you'll hear a second prompt that will say, your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor. We'll be answering questions in the order in which they are received. We'll go to the first question now. Once you hear the prompt, your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor, you can ask your first question.
Hello, it's Philip Nelson, practitioner in California. Question is, you already covered, it's kind of, the question now is who gets to define the abstract idea? So by analogy to the claim construction process, my question is, do you think there's going to be a Markman-like hearing process that develops in order to determine, you know, what's the abstract idea early on so that then people can litigate with that in mind? And if so, should the appellate courts get to reframe the abstract idea? What should be the standard of review after it's initially determined?
That's a great question, and in fact, it's been somewhat of an active question not just among academics and policy and people engaged in the policy base, but among lawyers such as yourself, ever since. Patentable subject matter kind of came roaring back in 4 years ago in the Bilski decision. Because right now it's currently unclear exactly at what point does a court make the determination that this is in fact, that the patent covers an abstract idea. Some people say the court should do this after the claims have been construed because you can't deem, whether this is an abstract idea or not until you know what the actual language in the patent claims state. Others and some in courts and other in courts in actual cases have taken an opposite view and have said, actually, no, I mean, we don't have to construe the claims, I mean, to tell us if this is an abstract idea, because the whole point is that if it's an abstract idea, then that preempts the whole need to construe the claims in order to get to the questions of novelty and non-obviousness and things of that sort. And this is one of the many kind of open questions that exist. If you ask me personally, I think that my personal views are that you can't know if it covers an abstract idea or not unless you've construed the claims, especially under the test that the court has embraced following its Mayo decision and that it reaffirmed in the decision in Alice just yesterday, this two-step test. You can't know whether there is a, quote, inventive step, unquote, that has been added to an abstract idea until you know what the claim actually says in terms of constituting that inventive step. And so this should be part of the claim construction process, or at least minimum should follow immediately upon claim construction. It's a question of law that is determined by a judge. In fact, in this case, the district court decided on summary judgment that the patent was invalid as under the patent statute. For failing patentable subject matter, because it involves a question of statutory interpretation in terms of the application of the patent statutes. And so, if you ask me, I think the most sensible procedural mechanism is to have the Markman hearing, and then there would be immediately summary judgment motions on whether this meets the test as formulated by the Supreme Court or not. The problem is, as I said, is that as you referred to in your question, we still don't really have any guidance as to what what counts as an abstract idea. It seems to be somewhat of a metaphysical question in that kind of pejorative sense of that term. I think you're going to start seeing a lot of cases going one way and a lot of cases going another, and a lot of uncertainty. And that's something that is not good for the innovation industries. It's, you know, if people are need to know that they need to invest tens of millions of dollars to come up with a program, and there's a concern that some judge may decide to frame it as abstract, that could seriously affect their decision to invest those millions of dollars in that innovation or put those millions of dollars in somewhere else, and do something else with it other than create new innovation.
So just as a quick follow-up, do you foresee practitioners seizing the initiative and trying to make two-part claims in the European style and saying the abstract idea of blah, and then additionally comprising all the rest of their limitations?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that's an evolutionary response to these cases or not. It could end up getting very complicated, as you know, given the single sentence rule and claims and whatnot of how to actually implement that type of practice, and whether it would work given kind of past claim construction norms and rules that we have with respect to the drafting of claims in the U.S. So, I don't know. And I think that we're going to see a lot of uncertainty and a lot of attempts to try to figure out the best ways to secure innovation for the clients who are their clients who are creating it. Unfortunately, when there's uncertainty, the only people who really win are lawyers. Maybe as a lawyer, one doesn't think that that's unfortunate. More money gets spent on lawyers and litigation, and less money actually ends up putting into the actual substantive matters of coming up with new innovation and getting it to market.
Thank you.
They're great. I think those are great questions, and it really highlight the tremendous amount of practical uncertainties that we have on a going forward basis from cases like this.
Okay, again, to ask a question, please push the star button on your phone pad and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll now entertain additional questions. While we're waiting to see if anyone else has a question, I'll go ahead and I'll make an announcement about our next Teleform. Our next Teleform conference call is going to be on Monday, June 23rd at 11 a.m., where we'll be hosting a conversation with current Securities and Exchange Commissioner Daniel Gallagher and former Securities and Exchange Commissioner Paul Atkins. So I invite you to consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls at the Teleform page of the Federalist Society's website, and to visit our podcast page, which includes podcasts of previously recorded Teleform conference calls. I don't see that we have any additional questions at the moment. Adam, do you have anything else you might want to make sure you cover today?
No, I think that I covered everything in my opening remarks, and I'm glad that my coverage was so thorough that there's no more questions.
Well, if there are no further questions, then I'm going to go ahead and thank Professor Mossoff for being our guest today on the Teleform. On behalf of the Federal Society, I also want to thank our audience. We welcome your feedback by email, which you can send to us at info@fed-soc.org. That's info@fed-soc.org. And please join us for our next Teleform conference call on Monday, June 23rd at 11 a.m. And until then, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.